I became interested in C.S. Lewis as a brand new Christian my first year in college. I was not academically inclined whatsoever. Nobody would have predicted that I would have become a full professor at a university because I was a PE major and I was an athlete. And I went to college for one reason. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, a poor part of LA, the very part of LA where the gangs started, actually. There's a documentary made about the gangs beginning in my neighborhood. So I went to college, and my older brother was a Christian, and he took me to a meeting, and I heard the gospel. I knew I was a sinner. I just didn't know I could be loved and forgiven. And I responded to it, and I was so grateful. So that first year, I read through the Bible from cover to cover. I think all of us as Christians should be reading it regularly, and I've just finished my 65th read through the whole Bible, and I've read the New Testament 42 times besides that, my Greek Bible almost three times. I'm not a great Greek scholar, but if I have a lexicon by my elbow, I can get by. And my mind started to wake up by reading the Bible. And then I wanted to tell people about the Christ of the Bible. So I'm sharing Jesus with people, and they're asking me questions. I have no clue the answer to those questions. So I thought, if that question is the only thing keeping you from faith, I won't leave a stone unturned. So I started picking up books, and of course, there was a name that cropped up in the literature, C.S. Lewis, and I started to grow. Now, I know people that say, I don't read other books, I just have my Bible. I say, I don't think you're reading the same Bible I'm reading, because my Bible doesn't shut me down and narrow my vision. It opens me up to a wider world where God has displayed his glory and his beauty in that world. And I want to read everything. So anyway, I started to grow. I had a professor who told me at the end of my college experience in America, when you graduate from university, they call that ceremony commencement. And the idea behind it is you don't get an education in university. You lay a foundation for an education. And commencement means you'll now commence your education by building on that foundation. And this guy said, pick an author who will take you places and make that author your life study. I think he could have said, pick a composer, pick an artist, pick a period of history, pick a country, but something that will keep you stretching with a sense of increased wonder and awe as you look at the world around you. And so that was my route to Lewis. I go to seminary, and I now I'm entering into a more academic life, and I have to write a thesis. As a PE major, I think the longest paper I wrote was 5 pages in crayon, you know. But now I have to write a thesis. And I wasn't going to write it on the use of the optative mood in the Greek text of Philemon. It just wasn't going to hold me. So I asked them if I could write on C.S. Lewis, and they said, yeah. So now I started putting pen to paper. Eventually, I went on and did my Ph.D. on C.S. Lewis as well in philosophy of religion. So I've been teaching him I've been studying him for 54 years, teaching him for 44 years, and I've lectured on Lewis in 81 universities and 20 different countries. And I'm surprised that people even want to know about this author that I was so interested in. Well, as a result of this, I don't know anything about art, really. And you'll find out about that by a couple of illustrations I'll share with you. But all the artists like C.S. Lewis. And so I'm often invited to speak at arts conferences about Lewis's perspective on some of these things. And that article you read in that book, the book was edited by Bruce Herman. And Bruce Herman was the head of the art department at Gordon College, and he also ran the Arts Institute in Orvieto, Italy. And we were at one of these arts conferences, and in the afternoons, all the people who were speaking at it would get together. And we did this for many, many years, and the conferences long ended. It went for about 10 years. But the people who spoke at it every year, we grew so close to each other, we still get together on Zoom calls every other week. Do you guys know the poet Malcolm Guite? So Malcolm is a part of it. When I go home, he's staying at my house when I get back. He's a very close friend. Scott Cairns, do you know that poet? Also, Scott's a part of it. Jeff Johnson, if you know him, Salem Music. And Bob Bennett, do you know that artist too? So anyway, and again, they're very magnanimous, these artists. They're big-hearted. They include a dumb C.S. Lewis scholar, so I'm happy. But we argued. Bruce Herman and I argued. He didn't think you could know objectively that something was beautiful. I said, well, I don't think anybody's ever going to get to the bottom of beauty. But I think you can have a sure word about things even if you don't have a last word about them. And I said, I think you can know objectively. And Lewis believed that. And Thomas Aquinas believed that. So we debated, and at the end of the debate, this shows you how magnanimous Bruce Herman is. He said, "You've convinced me. Why don't you contribute a chapter to this book?" So that's how that came about. And maybe a little of that is reflected in this talk today, if it's okay. In Surprised by Joy, Lewis's autobiography, where he doesn't give his full life story, but he gives that story of how he moved from atheism to faith. In Surprised by Joy, he said that the characteristic of his childhood was absence of beauty. He said, "I never saw a beautiful building and never knew a building could be beautiful." It was a real surprise to me because I lecture at Belfast, I don't know, once or twice a year. And the first time I lectured there was in 1999. And the person who owned Lewis's boyhood home invited me to come and spend 2.5 hours just tooling around in that house, looking at the world that was his childhood. And it was the most beautiful house I had ever seen in my life. And I had echoing in my mind his comment, Surprised by Joy, "I never saw a beautiful building and never knew a building could be beautiful." And I'm going, there's such incongruity here. And then he said the first beauty he ever saw was when his older brother Warren made a toy garden on the lid of a cookie tin and brought it into the nursery. And he said, "That was the first beauty I saw, and it wakened in my heart a longing for beauty." And then he makes this comment: "What all of the real gardens failed to do, that garden did." So he's not denying the existence of beauty out there. It's just that he didn't awaken to it until that moment. And his brother, in a sense, did an artistic work and created something that caused Lewis to awaken to beauty, and that beauty awakened in him also a sense of longing. And that's the work you're doing. You're creating works of art that others might notice it and something might awaken in their hearts. "The first beauty I ever saw," he said, "was that toy garden. The beauty had been all around him, and he had that awakening moment." My guess is we've all had these awakening moments. I first started coming to Eastern Europe when communism was still in power, and I would teach in underground schools. I got hassled by the secret police in Romania, for 6 hours. It's not a comfortable experience. I was in the Ceausescu days. And I thought to myself, I can leave, but these people have to stay here. I saw such courage among the Christians. And I did a lot of this work, but I was once for a month behind the Iron Curtain without my family. I was incredibly impressed with the courage of the people I was ministering among, but I was so homesick for my wife and my children. And I was busy, and I was working, and I was always shuttled from place to place, kind of clandestinely working. And I finally, at the end of a month, had one day free to myself, and I was in Prague. And I thought to myself, oh my heavens, I've never seen such a beautiful city. And I'm wandering around. Even the communists couldn't suppress the beauty of that city. 100 years of architecture, only place I know of where cubism architecture was actually put into stone and you know, masonry work. They built these buildings. Anyway, I'm wandering around, and I wander up to St. Vitus, the cathedral at the top of the hill. And I go in there, and I've never seen such glorious stained glass windows as I saw in that particular cathedral. And I got to the third window on the left, and I said, oh my heavens. It's the window by Alphonse Mucha, where he's depicting how Christianity came to the Slavic people when Cyril and Methodius came and led Ludmilla and Bozhevoy, the king and queen of the Slavs, to Christ. And their grandson was Wenceslaus, the first king in the Slavic world to grow up with a Christian background. And it's the whole thing. And then his martyrdom. And I'm looking at this window and the color and the vibrancy and so on. It took my breath away. I sat there for about 2 hours watching that window. I've been back to see it at least 12 times because it's so beautiful and so on. And I don't know about you, but my guess is each one of you have had occasions like that where you saw something that was so glorious that it beckoned you to camp there. Another time I was with my wife and one of my best friends, Mark Lewis, who's a theater professor at Wheaton College, and his wife, Mary. And we were in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. I'd never been there before. And we're wandering through, and all of a sudden, I came to Van Gogh's Cypresses in a Wheat Field. I don't know if you've ever seen it before. Maybe you've seen pictures of it in books. And here's this picture with all the vibrancy of a Van Gogh painting and the contrast of the colors and so on. And there's this turbulence in the air, and you can actually see the amber waves of grain, and you can almost, standing there, feel the wind come off of the canvas. It's so glorious. And I'm standing there right in the middle, and I go, oh my heavens. And I was there for at least 25 minutes, just standing there, taking it in, drinking it. And then I realized other people are gathering, and I'm right in the middle, and I'm hogging the best view of the thing. So I backed up, and there was a bench there. And I sat down on the bench, just grateful for whoever put the bench there. And then after about another 15, 20 minutes, I thought, wait a minute, I'm with Claudia and Mark and Mary, where are they? You know how art museums have the wide doors that go into the next room and so on? I'm looking down that way, I don't see Mark and Mary. I'm looking down that way, I don't see Mark and Mary and Claudia. And you know what else I don't see? A bench. A bench. Enough people must have had that experience in front of that painting that they put a bench in. And I've been back several times to that painting too. And there's benches all over the place now. But at that time, there was only one bench, and it was in front of that painting. There was something so objectively beautiful about that, and beckoning and calling to attention. But what's it calling, and what's it awakening? That's the thing that's interesting to me. Lewis talks of the awakening imagination. It breaks us out to some degree of the dungeon of self. And it helps us to see there's some transcendent reality operational in our world. He gave a lecture at Oxford University maybe 4 years after he became a Christian. And it's called On the English Syllabus. It's been published in an obscure Lewis book called Rehabilitations. And in that book, he says this to the students: we have fulfilled our whole duty to you if we can help you see some tract of reality. He wants them to see something, and that meant he wanted them to look at a book, for example, and not project on the book what they wanted to be there, but have the book awaken in them something, and they can see what's actually there. They can begin to see the objective reality. Owen Barfield, Lewis's friend, Lewis says you have different kinds of friends. Your first friend is a friend that reads all the same books you read and gets the same things out of them. That means you're not crazy. Other people have seen what you've seen. The second friend is a person who reads all the same books you read and gets something completely out of them, different, something different. So they become a dialogical friend, and your understanding increases and broadens beyond your present perspective. Barfield was that friend. And Owen Barfield wrote in a book that he did on C.S. Lewis, the experience of oneself over against that which is not oneself is a sine qua non of human consciousness. Sine qua non, that apart from which there is nothing. So you're seeing something different than yourself, and it's drawing you out of yourself to see, again, the wider world. That's in part the work of the artist who offers their work to the world. You're helping people see things they haven't seen before. In Experiment and Criticism, Lewis says, my own eyes are not enough for me. I would see what other people have seen. I would read what they have written. Even what they have written is not enough for me. I would read what they've imagined. Even that's not enough for me. I regret that the brutes cannot write books. Gladly would I see how the world presents itself to the eye of a mouse or a bee, or how it comes charged to the olfactory sense of a dog. How many of you have dogs? I let my dog out in the morning. When I first get up in the morning, I know immediately what I have to do. So I think when I let my dog out, I assume that immediately that's what he wants to do too. And he goes outside, and what does he do? He doesn't go to a tree. He sticks his nose up in the air, and he starts sniffing. And I say, what is he getting out of that experience? It's amazing to me. It's awakening me to something. And consequently, Lewis is warning against what he calls the transforming imagination, again, where we project onto things, or what psychologists call projection. We want a world bigger than ourselves. And he even said, I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else. He talks about, again, in that house, that tour of going through his boyhood home, he talked about how he could look out his window of his bedroom and he could see off in the distance the Hollywood Hills. And he said, they taught me longing. The Hollywood Hills were only about 2 miles from his house. But in his little legs, wandering that far, it would be like trying to go to the dark side of the moon. It seemed far away. But because they were far away, they taught him longing. He wanted to get to that place. And the heart awakened for some sort of transcendent reality. Lewis is writing science fiction. So here's an artistic endeavor. You're a writer. You know, you like to do your artistic work with the pen and so on. Lewis wrote science fiction. What was his reason for writing that? Well, he wanted to write romantic literature. Romantic literature comes from, basically, even the term comes from Virgil's Aeneid. So here's Virgil. He's a citizen of Troy. And Aeneas, the character, the fictional character depicted in that book. He's a citizen of Troy. The Greeks are destroying Troy. He's going to go try to fight against the Greeks. And he sees the ghost of his wife who's died in the fray. And the ghost of Hector, the crown prince, who's died in the fray. And they both tell him, you got to flee the city and you got to go build a new city. The city that he's going to build is Rome. And Virgil is trying to help the people of Rome understand their own history and take pride in their world by giving them a story. And so he's a man caught between two cities, the city of his birth and the city that will one day be. And Augustine didn't like the myths, but he liked that one because he thought it was depictive of all of our lives. We're born in a city and we have a hunger for another city. It's like Abraham in Hebrews 11, who is looking for the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And so the longing for Rome, the city that he would build, is where kind of the idea of romantic literature even comes from. So Lewis wants to write romantic literature to awaken in people the desire for a place, ultimately for heaven. But how do you do it? Our world's been discovered. You know, everybody's gone everywhere. We've seen all this stuff. So he thinks, I think I'm going to use science fiction because I can write about these things extraterrestrially and awaken desire as people are traveling to other planets and so on. So that's exactly what he was trying to do in that particular thing. And he wanted to awaken longing. That's the thing. And this longing is embedded in us, but it needs to be called out. It needs to be awakened. My son, Jeremy, my oldest son, when he was a boy, whenever there was a play at Wheaton College, we'd get a call from the theater prof and say, could Jeremy come and audition for this play? And he was auditioning one time to play young Pip in the adaptation of Charles Dickens' Great Expectations. And Pip is for the first third of the play, he's a major character. And here's Jeremy now living as a 10-year-old the life of a college student. And he's at rehearsals every day. And if we can't find him at home, we go up to the dorm of his friends, and he's in the dorm of his friends with their earphones on, rocking out to their music. And he's loving this life he's been living a part of. They had 14 performances. After the last performance, I go to pick him up. And we go walking through the theater, and he discovers for the first time that the students don't leave the theater after the last performance till they've dismantled the set. And he said, Dad, I've got to sit down. He looked like Obi-Wan Kenobi when that planet blew up, and he knew there was a disturbance in the Force. And he sits down, and he's just in horror. The world that so defined the last 2.5 months of his life is being destroyed. And I say after about 15 minutes, come on, Jeremy, we got to go. And he shuffles out to the car like an old man. We get to the car and he says, Dad, I didn't want it to end. I said, oh, but Jeremy, it's the nature of every play, it comes to an end. It's the nature of every holiday and vacation, it comes to an end. Matter of fact, it's the nature of every year in school, it will come to an end. Matter of fact, it's the nature of your own childhood, it will one day come to an end. Maybe you're longing for the one thing that never has to end. And he looked at me and he said, do you mean heaven, Dad? Do you mean heaven? That's what you're calling out of people when you do your artistic work. You don't want to do it manipulatively. Just tell the story truly that you're trying to depict in your canvas or in your music or in the books you're writing. Speak the truth. And if you speak the truth well, something of the transcendent will break through because truth is a name God even claims for himself. So anyway, beauty, as it did in Lewis's case, set his heart longing for another world. And like a child who says after a bedtime story, read it again. Lewis asks, why do they say this? They know the twists and turns of plot. They know where the story's going. They know the characters. He suggests that maybe they say it because that story awakened in them a longing for the world of that story, which awakens them a longing for the only other world they could ever really know. Beauty awakens longing and sets us on a quest to find the object of our deepest desire. And here, I think, beauty and truth meet. Beauty and truth need to meet. In The Abolition of Man, a book that Lewis wrote on objectivity, he tells the story of Samuel Taylor Coleridge at a waterfall. He's basically trying to analyze assumptions embedded in an English textbook. And he says, I don't think sometimes we pay enough attention to the philosophies that come to us through the book. And rather than teaching English grammar, the authors of this book, he calls it the Green Book, and he calls the authors Gaius and Titius. He didn't really want to embarrass them, but it was Control of Language by Alec King and Martin Ketley. I'll tell you their names. I don't mind embarrassing them because they've been gone for probably about 70 years. But nevertheless, they tell a story of Coleridge at this waterfall. And it was the Coralin waterfall in the River Clyde in Scotland. And there were two tourists there. And one of the tourists looked at the waterfall and said, it's pretty. The other tourist looked at it and said, it's sublime. One said it was pretty, and the other one says, you've got an idea of the Platonic ideal of waterfallness? This waterfall is the closest approximation I've ever seen to it. And Coleridge endorsed the one who said it was sublime and didn't endorse the one who said it was pretty. Why? What was the problem? They both were looking at the waterfall positively, but one of them spoke of it more robustly. The authors of the Green Book, though, by contrast, said Coleridge had no right to say that, no right to make that judgment whatsoever, because the people weren't saying anything about the waterfall. They were only saying something about their own feelings of the waterfall. Truth, people, is not reality. Truth is what I think about reality when I think accurately about it. Truth always requires, any truth claim always requires an objective reality to support the claim. This is a pen. That's true. Why is it true? Because there's a pen there. This is an elephant. That's false. Elephants exist. This isn't one. Now, there's some ambiguity in all of this. I call this a pen. The word is a symbol for what this is. I have a Magritte painting on my phone, and it's a pipe. And underneath it, it says in French, this is not a pipe. And Magritte painted that on the painting after he had made the painting of the pipe. Why? Because people were coming in, oh, it's a pipe, it's a pipe. It's not a pipe. Pipe is something you hold in your hand and smoke with your mouth. That was a painting of a pipe, and he knew that reality confirms the claim, and if there's no reality, then the claim isn't really asserted or affirmed. Okay, so I can use any word to describe this. We have the word symbol. Comes from two Greek words, soon, with, and balein, to cast. I cast together two things, a sound with one of these. And once I do that, once I say this is a pen instead of a Gazortenblatt or something like that, it's no longer arbitrary. It's got to have coherence with it if I'm going to have communication and community that develops around communication and culture that develops around communication. And consequently, then, if I deny reality and I project subjectively on it whatever I want it to be, like the authors of the Green Book said, then what ends up happening is language falls apart, communication falls apart, and community falls apart. And this is where we are in our culture right now, by the way. You can be whatever pronoun you want. You can be whatever gender you want. The reality doesn't matter. And the sad thing about it is we have re-entered into the region of the Tower of Babel. And as Lewis writes The Abolition of Man, he gives those warnings in the third chapter of that book. And then he writes an artistic work, That Hideous Strength, in order that he might depict what he wrote about propositionally in The Abolition of Man. In That Hideous Strength, it ends in Babel. Everything falls apart because there's no objective reality out of which I could begin to understand myself, those I'm living with, and also the world in which I live, and beauty itself. And so consequently, this whole idea, Lewis says, all judgments imply a standard. If you have an architect in Los Angeles who draws plans for a building and sends it to a contractor in New York City, When he says, you cut the board at 8 feet, he's assuming the guy in New York has the same understanding of what 8 feet is as he did when he drew the plans. All judgments imply a standard, and there needs to be an objective standard if we're going to make sense of our experience. Sometimes we can't get to it. That's okay. Then we call that opinion. Opinion is based on probability rather than certainty. It's subject to doubt, and reasonable people could differ in matters of opinion. That can happen too. And we're sensitive to that, but we realize that sometimes we, in our subjective projection, not only cloud us from seeing art, but put us in conflict with other people because we're denying this objective reality. I'll give you an example. Can I say Prague is the most beautiful city in the world? I can say it, but does it have merit? What's wrong with that statement? It's more flawed than that. An opinion can sometimes have merit. But why can't I say Prague is the most beautiful city in the world? I haven't been to every city. And all of a sudden, I'm taking my thoughts and projecting them on that and making it more authoritative than it actually is. Okay, so now can I say Prague is the most beautiful city I've ever seen? Now, what do you need to ask me about that? Huh? Yeah, what other cities have I seen? If I say Barstow, California, the city doesn't mean anything. Barstow is a horrible industrial place where they have a mountain and they're drawing gypsum out of the mountain. It's got all these factories there. I feel bad for the people that live there. You know, at least maybe they're getting beautiful character as they live there because they have to endure that experience. But if I say, I've seen Salzburg, I've seen Quebec City, oh my heavens. I've seen Budapest. I've seen Santa Barbara, California. I've seen Seattle. And I could go on and on and on about all the cities I've seen. Now, when I say Prague's the most beautiful city I've seen, it has some merit. But there's still a question you need to ask me. What is it? What is it?
By what measure you are.
Say it again. Is exactly right. If I don't have a definition for beauty, and if I don't have the capacity to apply it to the city, then to be honest, I just need to say, I really like Prague. And there's nothing wrong with saying I really like Prague. But I'm not then making judgments about other people because they're not on my page. And so I have to begin to think through these things as best I can. Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologica, he believed that you can make objective judgments about beauty. But if you do, then what is the characteristic of the thing whereby you say that is beautiful? And so he looks at all kinds of particulars. And he draws from the particulars abstractions. And he says, I've seen that something that's really beautiful, it will have integrity. That means it does what it's supposed to do. So integrity. In America, we buy Christmas trees at Christmas time. And you go, what tree do you buy? You go to the lot and you buy a tree usually that looks something like this. You don't buy one that looks like that and then it comes over here, it's got a few branches sticking out here. That lacks integrity. How do we get the concept of what a Christmas tree should look like? We've seen thousands of them over our life and we begin to abstract these ones are the more attractive and it has integrity to Christmas tree nests. Same thing with buying a pumpkin around the autumn. You buy one that's sort of plump and it's got a nice stem coming out and whatnot. You don't buy a disfigured one unless you want to make a jack-o'-lantern at Halloween or something like that. Then you want it for its disfigurement. But the problem is we look for something that has integrity. But as soon as we say that, then you get an artist like Picasso. And he did this one work of art where he is doing something that has integrity, but he comes at it from a completely different angle. And we see things that we didn't see before because he reveals something of the quality and character of that thing. Second thing it has to have besides integrity, it has to have proportion. But again, there's a lot of things we can do with proportion. And consequently, we want to see, what is the artist telling me when they do this painting? Or when they write this poem? And maybe break out of one poetic form in order to move us into another poetic form to draw our attention to the object of that work of art. We don't want to be too quick to judge it if it's not in the very tradition. Have you been to the Uffizi Museum in Florence? So the whole Uffizi set out, so they show step by step how the art began to develop as somebody took what was that was before them and then moved into some new nuance to show the next phase. C.S. Lewis said when it came to literature that most literature is embellishment. You take what had come before and you embellish it. So he writes an essay, What Chaucer Really Did to Il Filostrato. Il Filostrato is a story in Boccaccio's Decameron. And Boccaccio took his story from Virgil's Aeneid. Virgil took his inspiration from Homer's Odyssey. And each one is retelling a story, nuancing it in such a way to draw something out from their audience so that they might see. And then, of course, Chaucer writes Troilus and Cressida, and then Shakespeare takes inspiration from Chaucer, and he writes his play, Troilus and Cressida, and he doesn't do it as well as Chaucer did, by the way, Shakespeare. I don't think I could tell you why I think that's so. But we have it today. What's West Side Story? Romeo and Juliet. What's August Rush? It's Oliver Twist. The Robin Williams character is a Fagin character. What is Bridget Jones' Diary? Pride and Prejudice retold. What is Inception? It's a retelling of the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. You've got O Brother, Where Art Thou? It's a retelling of the Odyssey. And we can go on and on and on about this list of things. Lewis himself does it. He writes the Great Divorce. What's he doing with The Great Divorce? He's retelling, in a satirical way, the story of Dante's Divine Comedy. You've also got, in Lewis, Till We Have Faces, he's retelling the myth of Cupid and Psyche. And what is The Horse and His Boy? It's a retelling of Hamlet. But he's depicting a particular message he wants to give by using an older form and then putting it in new raiment. So we see some new things with it. And so I think these kinds of things are really important. And without an objective standard, the self-referential is at risk of becoming tyrannical. Prague is the most beautiful city in the world. If I don't consider the nuancing of that, I end up projecting on that, and I expect everybody else to see my point of view, and I then make demands that are not legitimate. And I said to my wife one time, she took a course on Picasso. And she came home and was telling me about Picasso. And I just said to her, Picasso is an idiot. She said, really? So what do you know about Picasso? And I had to confess I didn't know anything about Picasso. She said, well, the first thing we have to do is re-navigate who the idiot is here. And then we have to see if that idiot is educable. Now, you laugh about it when I tell you that story, but those kinds of comments are made constantly. Not only among those who go to see art, but even sometimes the artists, because they're not thinking truth has not met beauty at those particular places. This is bad what I've done, but it's also worse in the hands of religious people. C.S. Lewis said, of all bad men, the worst of bad men are religious bad men. The quicker I might be willing to die for my faith, maybe the quicker I'd be willing to kill for my faith. Or paint a thus saith the Lord across my own opinions. How many of you ever heard a person after preaching a sermon, I'm sure they were well-meaning, but they were misguided. They say, I'm not telling you this. This is the word of God. No, you told me that. You gave me your best interpretation of the text. And I hope you did due diligence, and I suppose that you did. You studied the text. But if I come back 10 years from now, you preach that same text, I hope you can take me deeper. And you extended the doctrine of inerrancy to your interpretation. And that's borderline blasphemy. I don't think you blasphemed because I don't think you were aware you were doing it. But nevertheless, we have to be careful lest we take the Bible and use the Bible like a ventriloquist uses his dummy. And sometimes we as artists can do that as well if we're not careful. Tell the story well, tell it as best you can. But again, I don't think, this is a pen, that's true. That's a sure word, I can have confidence in it. But it's not a last word about what this is. I take the confidence of the sure word and I hold it in an open hand of humility because this is not a last word. This is a pen, that's true, but it has a length, it has a width, it has a molecular structure, has a chemical compound for its ink, it has a history from the iron stylus to to the feather quill pen, to a ballpoint, this is a gel pen, to whatever. And then it has a function, how it writes on paper, how it writes on cardboard, how it writes on paper smeared with butter. I can go on and on and on about this. The word, it's a pen, is not diminished by the fact it's not a last word. But it is diminished if I think it's the only word. I hold it with humility. There's more to be known about that. And so here, this honesty for the artist and the honesty for trying to understand beauty and the use of the imagination in that process becomes important. Why? Because we can begin to project on things our self-referentialism and our sin, basically, on things. So George MacDonald, an author who influenced C.S. Lewis, he said, "We do not have souls. We are souls. We have bodies." If you tell a child he has a soul, he thinks like anything else he has, his pen, his keys, his coat. He could lose it and leave it behind. He thinks he dies and goes to the grave, his soul goes off someplace else. MacDonald says, no, tell the child he is a soul. And when he dies, he goes to heaven and he leaves his body behind, like clipped hair on a barbershop floor, for some of you that still go to barbershops, right? So consequently, what is a soul? And I've read a lot of stuff on this. I think I could prove the existence of soul. If you want to talk about it, we could talk about it afterwards. But basically, we have seen traditionally that the soul, this immaterial part of what it is to be human, has a thinking part, reason, has a feeling part, emotion, and has a choosing part, volition. And C.S. Lewis makes it clear that reason is hands down the weakest of those three. If I sin, if I use my will in a way where I do something inappropriate, my reason doesn't kick in and say, boy, Jerry, that's stupid. You're just going to hurt yourself and hurt other people if you continue down that path. No, my reason being weak begins to encapsulate the bad choice with rationalization and justification, and it leads to moral blindness. Aristotle used the phrase akrasia. It means to lose command of my moral life because I've justified my bad acts. Lewis himself said, continued disobedience to conscience makes conscience blind. And you can have art that moves in that direction too. It's not telling the true story. And then you have Paul, who in Romans 1:18 says, we suppress the truth in our unrighteousness. Furthermore, the reason being weak, if my emotion, if I'm hurt by somebody, my reason being weak doesn't tell me you need to grieve what was done to you and you need to forgive the person who hurt you so that you don't become bitter. No, my reason being weak encapsulates that pain, puts it in a little cyst on my soul. It fills with pus. You bump into me and I'm gonna exhibit that poison and that toxicity in your direction. Instead, my reason should be saying you should grieve and forgive. And so consequently, the reason is weak. And Lewis says, reason stands like dragon sentries before my heart, deflecting what will get through to that heart. How do you get past the dragon sentries in the midst of self-deception? And Lewis says, sometimes story gets past the watchful dragon. I could say sometimes poetry gets past the watchful dragons. Sometimes music gets past the watchful dragons. Sometimes studio art gets past the watchful dragons. Sometimes theater gets past the watchful dragons. Lewis sees the value of all of this. It's very important. Matter of fact, we as Christians understand it too. So David, the king, has just committed adultery and he's covered it over with murder. There's a rationalization of the bad act. And you're the prophet Nathan. And God tells you, you got to go tell David what he's done was not right. What do? He's already killed one person. So what does Nathan do? How does he get past the watchful dragon?
He tells a story.
Jesus is talking to people who have eyes that cannot see and ears that cannot hear. And what does he do? He uses parables to get past those things. He uses art. He is basically depicting these things. Getting past the watchful dragons. Let's consider some of the ways. Reality itself is a great guide. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the poet, said, every bush is a burning bush and the world is crowded with God. He's there, just like Lewis. What none of the real gardens ever did for me, this toy garden did. The beauty is there, but maybe we just haven't seen it yet. How do we awaken that in people? C.S. Lewis said, God walks everywhere incognito. Our responsibility is to awaken to him and even more to remain awake. And your responsibility as an artist is to tell the truth as best you can by depicting reality in ways that maybe people didn't see. Maybe it's like in the Uffizi, you come at it tangentially at a different angle and you help people see, wow, there's a better way. There's a thing called perspective, you're kidding. What do we do with that? Oh, there's a thing called shadows and painting things so that the sun comes from a common source. What do we do with that? There's the telling of the truth. The great aid, the artist must cultivate an awareness of the presence of God in the world. And I think the consequence of that is our sense of his presence will begin to basically prompt us moving in the right direction. Lewis says when we are trying to discover something of the world, reality, he says you can have a thing called the pupil's metaphor. This is when I don't understand the truth of a thing. And so I say, okay, maybe it's like this. I have a metaphor or I have a depiction. While I'm groping to understand the reality that satisfies the longing of my heart. And then you have a master's metaphor, however. That's when a person does understand and they depict a metaphor to bring those who don't understand into the realm of the master's grasp. But then there's even more, because we don't get to the bottom of anything. You have the sure word, but you don't get the last word. You haven't seen all the applications of this. And I'll give you an example. So C.S. Lewis, on his process to faith, he had been an atheist. He reasons his way through the morass of atheism and its supporting worldview, materialism. He reasons his way through agnosticism, and he finally becomes a theist. But he doesn't think he could know God personally, and he says in his autobiography, any more than Hamlet could know Shakespeare. Even when he's thinking about these things, he's using play, he's using the world of art and the world of depiction in order to explain it to somebody. I didn't think I could know God personally any more than Hamlet could know Shakespeare. He has a late night discussion with J.R.R. Tolkien shortly after that. And Tolkien says, I don't get it, Lewis. You like the myths. You like the stories. You like the stories of the gods coming down and having relationship with humans. How come you won't accept it at the one place where it reports to be true? And Lewis, it dawned on him. The only way Hamlet could ever get to know Shakespeare is not by Hamlet, the character, breaking out of the play, but Shakespeare, the author, could have written himself into the play and made the introduction between Shakespeare and Hamlet possible. 2 weeks after that discussion with Tolkien, he becomes a Christian. And later, he will write the Narnian Chronicles. And Tolkien didn't like them. He said, what are you doing? You got dryads and naiads. You got minotaurs. You got fauns. You even got Santa Claus in these books. What are you doing bringing in all these myths? And Tolkien didn't realize he was the one that prompted that, Lewis. Lewis had come to the place where he said, all of the myths were, for the pagan society, much like the Old Testament was for the Jews. They were tutors to lead them to the place where the story was real. And the artists can do that, help people see there's a bigger thing, there's a bigger story going on here, and it's a glorious one. So the pupil's metaphor, the master's metaphor, so think of it. When he first says, I didn't think a person could know Hamlet anymore, I didn't think I could know God any more than Hamlet could know Shakespeare. That's the pupil's metaphor. When all of a sudden he picks it up from Tolkien, Hamlet could have written himself in the play and he describes it. Now it's the master's metaphor. He's describing it so we could understand how we come in. Is the story done? No. There's always room for the imagination to take us deeper and understand more. So let's go on a tour. We're going to take a field trip. We're going to get in a time machine and we're going to go back to Elsinore in about, I don't know, the 13th century. And we're going to put on the garb of the people that are courtiers at that time. And we're going to be talking, and we're going to say, things have been mighty strange here in Elsinore. The king's died in the height of his strength. The queen, Gertrude, has married her brother-in-law. And instead of the crown going to Hamlet, the crown prince, it's gone to his uncle, Claudius. And Hamlet's been acting kind of strange, though some people say there's a method to his madness. And Ophelia, she's a basket case. And we're talking about these things as we're walking through the courtyard, and all of a sudden, this little man in Elizabethan tights with a goatee, frizzy hair, and an earring, he shows up, And we say, who are you? This is a strange time. How'd you get past the guards and what are you doing here? And he says, I'm Shakespeare. I created your world. And I came here to tell you about it because I want you to know that I know things have been sketchy, but it's going to get better eventually. And I want you to know things will work out. And what do we say to that little man? Yeah, sure. And as long as there's skepticism, there's people who are saying, yeah, sure, there's always room for more work in the imagination. So we move from Hamlet to Shakespeare, Shakespeare to Hamlet, and then the larger world. This story that you're telling, this world that you're awakening people to, it is one that everybody's interested in. And everybody's been referring to, one way or another. Everybody's probably overstated. But many people are interested in it and looking at it. And I'll give you an example. We're trying to find out how God is at work in our world. In good times, when there's sunrises and sunsets, when there's an immediate post-rain with the green foliage glistening and a rainbow stretched across the sky and the curl of a wave on a beach, the exhibitions of God's glory that the scriptures say, the heavens declare the glory of God, the earth shows the sand of the earth. It's easy to portray that stuff. When I was in college, everybody was reading Francis Schaeffer. I thought, I think I could follow Jesus in the Swiss Alps. I think I could. But I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, where the playgrounds were surrounded by chain link fences. And there were cracks in the asphalt, and grass was growing through the cracks, and grass was growing at the base of the chain link fences, and the chain link fences were like nets that captured trash, and that was a world I grew up in. Is there beauty there? And I think there is if we would willingly distill it out. God is at work in that world. Look at Lamentations. When was it written by Jeremiah? At the time of the Babylonian captivity, at the collapse of Jerusalem. And what does he do as an artist? Does he give up? No. He writes the most stylized poetry in the Hebrew Bible. Five chapters. Chapters 1 and 2 and chapters 3 and 4 have 22 verses. Each verse starts with the successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet, 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. Chapter 3 has 66 verses, and it repeats the pattern. And it's so stylized, the poetry. Here's a guy who's grieving over the destruction of his city, and he produces some of the best art in the Old Testament. It's interesting. The story is always somehow coming through, if we would willingly distill it out and look. The truth is too big to hide. So one time I was at home. We didn't let our kids watch television when it was a school week when they were young. Except on the weekends, we'd let them watch it. And one weekend we were watching Walt Disney's The Jungle Book. It's the adaptation from Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book. And we're watching that film, and it's Mowgli, the boy. He's been lost by his family. He's been adopted by Baloo the bear and Bagheera the panther. And the tiger, Shere Khan, wants to kill him. And there comes a moment in the play where the showdown occurs, and Baloo the bear puts himself in harm's way to save Mowgli. Lightning strikes the tiger. He goes running off, and Bagheera the panther is walking off the boy, and they're looking over their shoulders at the limp body of their dear friend. And Bagheera the panther says, "Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for a friend." That just doesn't sound like Kipling to me. I blew the dust off of my Jungle Book, and it's not in there. Where is it? John 15. How did it get in a Disney movie? Years later, I was asked to come to speak to all the Disney artists about story, particularly from Lewis and Tolkien. They told me I could have 45 minutes lecture, 45 minutes Q&A, and I shouldn't use it as a time to proselytize. If I had to talk about their faith where it was essential to their storytelling and their art, that's okay. I don't need to proselytize. If I can get them interested in those authors, when I leave, those authors will still be speaking to them as they read them. But they told me in the 45 minutes of Q&A, you can answer forthright any question our artists ask. I give the lecture, first question. Weren't Lewis and Tolkien Christians? Could you tell us about that? Next question. Isn't Aslan in the Narnian books a Christ figure? Could you tell us about that? Next question, in the Tolkien books, are there any Christ figures, like when Gandalf the Grey gives up his life to save the Fellowship of the Ring when they're attacked by the Balrog, and he dies Gandalf the Grey and comes back Gandalf the White? Isn't that a Christ depiction? Are there others in the Tolkien books? Wasn't it Tolkien who had a hand in Lewis coming to faith? Could you tell us about that? Every question in that 45 minutes was along that line. The artists then go back to work. About 20 artists come walking up to me. And I recognize them. They're the ones that were asking me the questions. They said, "You're a Christian, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah. Are you?" They said, "Yeah. Why do you think we were asking you those questions?" They're trying to use it as an opportunity to witness to their fellow artists. I said, "Okay, I have a question for you. How did greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for a friend, get in the Disney movie, The Jungle Book?" And they go, "Oh, we've been smuggling stuff in here for years." And then they said, "But others have been smuggling other stuff in too." But the deal is, you think about film. You think about the story of the king and queen that can't have a child. And all of a sudden the queen's expecting and everybody's excited. She gives birth to a little girl. Everybody's invited to the christening. Somebody gets left out. And consequently they come and curse the child at birth. And the curse can't be unwound unless some prince comes from a distant land and either vanquishes the foe or lays down his life to save the prince. Does that sound vaguely familiar to any of you? But it's depicted in New Raymond. James Cameron, do you guys know who he is, the director? Every time I've heard him interviewed, he trashes Christianity. But have you ever noticed he's always telling our story? Terminator 2. You have this man and this woman and her child, and an alien from another world comes and lays down his life to save them. The next movie he makes, he spent more money making that movie than any movie had ever been made. $200 million to make the Titanic. He builds a set a quarter the size of the original Titanic. He has big box office draws. Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. He has music, Celine Dion and her ascendancy. He has special effects. But now he's got to tell a story. He tells our story. There's a guy named Jack who wins a ticket to the doomed ship and goes immediately to the bow of the ship, makes the shape of the cross, and says, "I'm king of the world." There's a girl stuck on that ship. She's been promised a marriage to a guy who's like the devil incarnate. She's engaged to this guy who's like the devil incarnate. Her father has died and left them penniless, and the mother says, "I'm not going to be a washerwoman," so she pushes her daughter in to bear the burden for the family, and she sees no way out, so she goes to stern the ship. She's going to take her life, and Jack just happens to be there to save her life. They bring the old lady back now once they've discovered the Titanic. They tell us the story of that night. She tells the story, and they say, "We have no record of him on the register." She says, "Isn't that amazing? But he saved me in every way." It's interesting. Does that sound familiar? What's the next movie Cameron makes? Avatar. About a guy who takes on the flesh of that world and goes in to save that world. What does Avatar mean in Sanskrit? Incarnation. You see it over and over again. Tale of Two Cities. Sidney Carton lays down his life for Charles Darnier. You've got it in Les Miserables, where the bishop basically redeems Jean Valjean's life, and Jean Valjean becomes the one who lays down his life for the miserable people who are suffering in his world. You see it over and over and over again. Not all books do this, not all art depicts it, but the art that elevates our souls or the art that basically captures this in new and unique ways. It's not all repetition. It's not all exactly the same, but the story keeps coming through. You look at your world and you see it, and it awakens in you a heart that is called out by the beauty you see, or the beauty you stretch to see even in a difficult situation. Les Miserables would be a good example. Here's a miserable world, and here's something glorious that's demonstrated in that world. How do you then, having been called out, how do you help others call it out in your work?